welcome to Power Problems, a podcast from the Cato Institute, where we offer a skeptical take on U.S. foreign policy and discuss some of today's big questions in international security with guests from across the political spectrum. I'm Emma Ashford.
And I'm Trevor Thrall.
Happy holidays from all of us here at Power Problems. As we wind down the year, we wanted to review everything that happened in 2018. It's been a very busy year. And then we wanted to think about what might lie ahead in 2019. That's year three of the Trump administration. Joining us for our discussion today is Eric Gomez, our colleague at Cato and previous podcast guest. Welcome back.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
So let's start by reviewing the year. What were the highlights that you guys took away from 2018?
What's old is new again in nuclear weapons policy. We got a discussion of arms control agreements with withdrawal from the INF, the nuclear modernization budget that is currently a very hot topic for the incoming Congress, with people like Adam Smith, representative from Washington, talking about putting some restraints on it again. So I'm tracking that very closely and will be in the year to come.
Yeah. So what's old is new again, but all those deals are getting killed by John Bolton, right?
Yes. Now, Bolton is adding more and more trophies in his pursuit to get rid of all arms control, it seems. He was directly responsible for the 2002 ABM treaty, biting the dust, and now he went after the INF. So who knows what's next?
Yeah. Bolton, that raises the point that Trump's national security team was an ongoing issue in 2018. Who's in, who's out, who's up, who's down. Certainly that has been a big issue. I think, what's fascinating is that a lot of these issues at one point seemed like they were all encompassing in 2018, only to be completely forgotten for the rest of the year because of the sort of circus in DC. So, the war on terror continues apace. We can talk about Afghanistan, we can talk about Iraq, we can talk about Syria. All those things were news for at least a day in 2018 and are huge stories. But, sitting here at the end of the year, you're like, wow, in another year, that might have been maybe the only story, but there's just so much.
Yeah, it does seem like there's been a bit more continuity in the Trump administration, inside the White House, at least, over the last 6 months, right? I mean, because the first 6 months of the year, we saw a huge amount of change over in the administration. But we've had John Bolton as national security advisor for about 6 months. We've had General Mattis around for longer than that. Pompeo's been Secretary of State for about that long. So it does seem like we might have reached an equilibrium there.
Though you have sort of impending, retirements or whatever you want to call people leaving, with the, I think, new year, you're going to get at least a couple new faces. Kelly, I think, is going to leave soon. Wouldn't surprise me for, Nikki Haley leaving. I wouldn't surprise me if Mattis finally gives up. This might be the calm before the storm.
Yeah, there's plenty of room for big personnel changes to come and some implications for foreign policy, especially with those. Also, I think the sort of investigation that's going to the Mueller investigation, as it continues to sort of wrap up more and more things, could add another wrinkle to that.
Yeah, that's true, because a lot of the changes that we previously saw were, if not associated with the Mueller investigation, then sort of knock-on effects from it. So we haven't really talked about Russia. Russia in 2018 was almost less of a foreign policy issue and more of a domestic policy issue, which is rather unusual.
Yeah, the politics of Russia have just kind of gone topsy-turvy over the last couple of years. And 20 years ago, you never would have predicted the way Russia would get handled. The idea that there's two sides to the Russia story on the domestic front is bizarre to me. It's like,
For me, the big story of 2018 is sort of the other country that's been interfering in our elections and just putting a bunch of money all around DC, and that's the Saudis and the Emiratis, particularly the changing U.S.-Saudi relationship. So after the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, we have seen a pushback in Congress, among the media, against the sort of the continuing U.S.-Saudi relationship that would have been unthinkable even a year ago.
Yeah, no, that's very true. It's, it may be a sign that 2 years in, after, a lot of talk off camera by Republicans in Congress, that there's finally a threshold that has been reached where now it's time that they finally feel pushed, compelled to do stuff in public to push back against Trump. I mean, there've been a little bit here, a little sanctions on Russia they didn't want, but this is really the first big, sign that Congress is ready to push back.
Yeah, we've seen those recent votes on things like war powers on Yemen, where Congress seems to be reasserting itself. But I don't think that's the story of 2018. I don't think Congress has actually reasserted itself on foreign policy as much as we might like to believe it.
Yeah, definitely not yet. There are some encouraging signs that it could be coming and more could be coming down the pike next year. But you're right, Emma. I think that it's still going to be a long way for Congress to really get back to its sort of constitutionally defined roles when it comes to overseeing the stuff that goes into foreign policy, if not necessarily foreign policy itself.
Yeah, I think, you know, Congress is kind of all about potential energy. It's not actually realized at the moment. Lindsey Graham said something after the Gina Haspel briefing that was extremely honest. And he said, if Pompeo and these guys were Democrats, I'd be all over them for this. And, you know, like, dude, really? So what you're saying here is what we all kind of know, but no one's supposed to actually say it out loud, which is I would use this as, you know, political advantage because it's obviously such a terrible, you know, thing that the Trump administration is doing. But since it's the Republican administration, I'm going to pull my punches. I'm going to say I don't like it, but I'm not going to go to the mattresses here. And that's what I think people are kind of like, wow, Trump represents such a departure. Why isn't Congress willing to go all out to push back? And the reason is politics, of course.
Yeah, I mean, so perhaps this previews a little that we're going to get to talking about the future in 2019 in a bit. But it does seem like there's a few big issues on the table where this incoming Democratic Congress might actually make a difference. Investigations is one of those areas, whether it's the Russia investigation or whether it's things like the fact that Secretaries Pompeo and Mattis might have misled Congress over the Khashoggi killing. Those are areas where you might see, you know, nominally oversight investigations, right? But we all know it's partisan. But then there's more serious policy implications too, right? So maybe budget stuff. Eric, mm-hmm. You alluded to nuclear modernization. Do you want to talk a little more about that?
Yeah. So the Obama administration put in place this very big nuclear modernization plan where the United States would be replacing or upgrading essentially almost every aspect of its nuclear delivery system, from new bombers, new missiles, new submarines, and also actually having some new warhead designs as well. And there's something called the bow wave, where a lot of these costs are sort of going to be hitting the system at relatively the same time, requiring a lot more money to pay for them. And I think Trump, not only with his sort of general view to nuclear strategy, but also the nuclear posture review that came out earlier this year, showed that nuclear weapons are going to play a much bigger role in American security strategy during his administration. And so there's been a lot of pushback now from mostly from House Democrats about, well, can we afford this at its current pace? Can we, you know, really be spending probably upwards of $1 trillion over the next 30 years or so on doing all of these things? Or can we cut some systems, delay some systems, sort of play with the budget to make it less sort of daunting of a budgetary challenge?
Yeah, the Trump administration's been very almost schizophrenic on defense budget issues like right. this. We saw Trump demand sort of more and more money for the troops, and I'll fund the military at these high levels, and then announced that actually he was going to make cuts on the budget. It was $17 or $18 billion mm-hmm. that just disappeared overnight from the defense budget. So he's been really inconsistent on this question.
And you know what's interesting too, listening to Eric, I remember, you know, there's some heartburn over the $1 trillion price tag of the modernization plan that remember Obama announced, and there's, you know, the potential for playing politics if it's Obama's plan. But 2 years in, one of the things I think you can say about where we've gotten to by the end of 2018 is that Trump now owns all of this stuff. They've done their review of this. They've done their review of that. They've released a new national security strategy. They've released the nuclear posture. All of these things we've talked about on the podcast, of course. So go back and find those episodes. All very good. But at this point, you know, Trump owns this stuff. So whatever the state of affairs is today, it's because Trump's team has at least begun to start to make it their own. I mean, they haven't finished much of anything, but it's now theirs and it's in process, and you can start to see the direction. You may not understand why. The justification and coherence is kind of low on some of these mm-hmm. things, but it's Trump's now.
You know, the other area that I sort of wanted to hit in our discussion of 2018 is an area where I don't think the Trump administration has actually taken control of U.S. foreign policy, and that's the ongoing wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the U.S. presence in Syria, our assistance in Yemen, even troops in Africa that we've talked about a couple of times in the podcast. It seems like the war on terror is basically this giant juggernaut just continuing to run. The Trump administration seems almost uninvolved in it, right? Donald Trump hasn't visited the troops. We almost never hear anything about, say, Afghanistan or Iraq, except the occasional death. This is kind of strange, right?
Yeah. And well, you hear that some things in Afghanistan are probably deteriorating and moving in the exact opposite direction what commanders have sort of been saying, oh, we're going to turn the corner, or, you know, victory is in sight, that sort of stuff. And it definitely seems like the facts on the ground are against us there. And that was one of the few things, Afghanistan especially, was one of the few things in Trump's campaign that, you know, I personally was sort of like, yeah, that's a good point, the way he said he wants to get out of Afghanistan and he believes that our presence there is not serving any real purpose anymore. But since coming in, he has done sort of, you know, sort of let it run on autopilot. It'd be interesting to see if he, as 2020 comes closer, if he kind of takes a more personal interest in that to maybe shore up his reelection fortunes.
Yeah, that actually just... not to foreshadow too heavily, but Afghanistan is going to be one of my future answers in a few minutes. But yeah, I think, you know, the autopilot function is very strong with the war on terror, and Obama inherited and continued most of, you know, what Bush had started, and now Trump has inherited from Obama that, you know, there's an awful lot of inertia in the system, and Trump's sort of mindset of let the generals do their thing. Plus, I think this fear of being the first person to get tagged with losing anything, I think that's anathema. And so the response has been to juice everything up 15% from what Obama was doing to make it look like you're better, more forceful, and then leave it alone.
It's about 25%, actually. At least in the Middle East, it's about 25% more troops in every theater. So,
yeah. And the other part of the continuity is none of it's working. So,
are you tired of winning?
Well, so much winning.
On that note, then, let's just quickly wrap up sort of the Trump administration of foreign policy. We have discussed this a whole bunch on this podcast and in other forums. What grade would you give the Trump team for 2018? Are the adults in the room winning, or is this something that's not going particularly well?
I will give Trump a lot of credit for his summit with Kim Jong-un. As a sort of watcher of East Asia, one of the most frustrating things has been sort of U.S. inertia or unwillingness to sort of be kind of bold in its approach to North Korea. And that was definitely a very sort of move that only Trump could really make. Unfortunately, I think his management style in general is just so not well suited for it. And that's why things are sort of stalling out now. But I think that, you know, that is an example of, in terms of Trump's ability to kind of break certain foreign policy orthodoxy just by sheer force of him being him, can sometimes be a good thing. And if he does get us out of Afghanistan, that also could be a good thing. But at the caveat of the whole management of it is probably not going to be very smooth. So I think, you know, if I was assigning a grade to the administration overall for the year, probably like a C minus. Definitely a lot of things that I don't think are particularly good, but also nothing that is too damning either right now.
Yeah, interesting. I would, let me first preface my grade by giving a sense of scale. So the Bush administration, I would grade it as an F for launching the war on terror in the sort of the manner they did and failing to make course corrections. The Obama administration, I would give a B-, because although Obama was much steadier, I think, in general, and didn't make most things worse, he also, I don't think, didn't do much to make things better. The Trump folks, I think, are somewhere in between. Eric, I was going to say something like a C or C-. Could have been worse would be my, Larry David sort of callback. It could have been worse. And the problem with Trump for me is, to be fair, I give him a C-. My concern is that he's not going to keep performing at that level. And whereas with Bush and Obama, you kind of felt like you knew what you were going to get. You could predict based on past behavior and statements, yesterday mean something today. I don't think you can predict that. So.
It's funny. I was going to say C minus two. You know, if I'm going to show my sort of millennial nature, I would say, well, in Harry Potter grades, it would be exceeds expectations. But I actually think that's a pretty good description for the Trump administration, right? They are actually exceeding our expectations. Our expectations might be artificially low, but they're doing okay considering everything else.
Boy, that's sad.
when you're starting from the bottom, there's only one way you can go, right?
That's right. We're lying down in the mud, but we're looking up at the stars. Okay.
Well, that I think that provides us a pivot to our next segment, which is we're going to do a quick lightning round here. I'm going to ask you guys some very quick fire questions, and then we'll move on to 2019. So best book you read in 2018?
I haven't finished it, but I'm about halfway through the Grant biography by Ron Chernow, and it's very, very good. It's very sort of interesting, the different levels of detail that Ron has in the book. And yeah, it's just a fascinating thing. I'm learning a lot about my own country's history that I didn't really know the fine details of before. And it's a lot of fun. So definitely recommend picking it up.
Yeah. So that sounds like a hard read, but a good one. I finally got around this year to reading Victor Cha's book Power Play about the sort of birth and development of the alliance, U.S. alliance system in Asia, and sort of realizing now that the future of U.S. foreign policy is unfortunately linked to China and Asia, I figure I got to start learning now. So a pretty good book.
You know, the most terrifying book I read this year was Jeffrey Lewis's 2020 Commission, which is this, it's a War of the Worlds style fake history of a nuclear exchange between North Korea and the US. And it is extremely well written and footnoted. So even though it's speculative history, it is fascinating and terrifying. And I highly recommend it if you enjoy not sleeping after reading fiction. So... Okay. So what about, this is a question mostly for Trevor and I, the most interesting episode of the year for the podcast, or perhaps the conversation you most enjoyed recording for the podcast? I know what mine is. Mine was our conversation with Matt Rajansky on Russia. And that's just because we don't get to talk about Russian foreign policy in that context nearly enough.
Yeah, for sure. That was a great one. I guess I will, although this is a hard one because we had many great conversations, I really enjoyed the conversation that Sahar and I had with Bruce Gentleson about his new book, Peacemakers, and the role that individual leadership still plays in global politics. That was, he had, done great sort of deep dives on various leaders and what made them effective. And I found that really inspiring.
Okay. Favorite foreign policy article of the year?
James Acton in International Security wrote a great piece about escalation and entanglement risk, basically talking about how a lot of things that the United States does or a lot of systems that the U.S. uses for non-nuclear missions are also now sort of entwined with conventional mission sets and that there are incentives to target those for conventional reasons that could have nuclear escalation implications. And, you know, if the theme of what's old is new again regarding nuclear weapons, I think this is something that's new that I think is understudied, and it was great to see James take a real deep dive into that that area.
Yeah, mine's from Foreign Affairs too. I really enjoyed Caitlin Talmadge's article on China and the potential for security spirals in East Asia. I thought that was just very well written.
I'm going to punt a little bit on a singular favorite and note that, and I hate to do this, but I'm going to go back to Foreign Affairs. The they had recently a nuclear anthology, sort of six different articles looking at the nuclear sort of issue. John Mueller had an issue, of course, as the sole kind of skeptic about the concerns, but that was really good. In fact, you know, since I teach graduate courses in international security, it turns out to be a very wonderful sort of up-to-date, sort of look at the debate over the threat of nuclear weapons and what to do about them. Not as good as a certain nuclear anthology is going to be next year, Eric, but still pretty good.
That'll be my favorite article of next year when
we already know the answer.
Nuclear anthology that Caroline Dormany and I here at Cato have been working on as editors is in the process. It's moving along and we're really excited about a lot of the chapters in there, and we can't wait to release it and talk about it some more.
Okay, couple of last questions here. Next Trump advisor to get defenestrated from the administration?
Mattis.
I'm not sure if Mattis, I think Mattis will be the next one to go, but I'm not sure if defenestration is accurate. I think it'll have to be someone who gets fired. And I wonder if Trump will gun for Mueller as things get closer. So he's not really an administration official in that sense, but that would be, yeah, that would make for some crazy times.
Okay, best mustache on a national security advisor?
So there's the obvious answer, but I think that Elbridge Colby grew out a beard at one point in the last year. I think I saw a picture of that. And I, you know, I think that I would judge that as part of it, even though he wasn't national security advisor, but a former official from the DOD.
Oh, that was really just an opportunity to relive my favorite headline of the year, which was David Rothkopf's John Bolton's mustache is more qualified to be national security advisor than he is.
It is an impressive mustache, though, to be fair.
Okay, final pair of questions here. Most overrated foreign policy development of the year, most underrated foreign policy development of the year?
I'm going to be a little I'm going to do a twofer. I think the INF issue and the potential from withdrawing from it was both over and underrated. I think some aspects of it were overrated in terms of, I think the some of the changes in terms of U.S. force structure probably won't be as dire or as bad as some have said. But I think the underrated is its discussion as part of this broader weakening of arms control regimes recently and sort of new nuclear dynamics between the U.S. and other great powers that are starting to just sort of emerge that I think are going to be pretty risky or dangerous for any potential future conflict.
Yeah, for me, overhyped is going to be China. You know, this reminds me, 2018 kind of reminds me of the 90s, mid-90s, when China threat inflation became a kind of a full-time job for a lot of people in D.C. And there was a lot of hyperventilation about every little thing China did that you could look at sideways. And I think we're back to that. It's not that it's not a real issue, a real threat, but it's to me, it's the biggest overhype threat. And to me, the most underrated development really is the utter failure of Trump's Afghanistan strategy. It's again, it doesn't get much talk because who the heck wants to talk about it? Certainly not Trump. But there's sort of scuttlebutt now that Trump is looking to pull out before the next election and needs to be able to call it a victory. So things are happening, but this is the worst possible time to try to negotiate a deal with the Taliban who are ascending. So the utter failure in Afghanistan has really slid under the radar.
Yeah. So for me, I'd say the most overrated foreign policy development of the year is actually the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. After everything that has happened in the U.S.-Saudi relationship in the last 25 or 30 years, you know, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, 9/11, all of these developments, and we're talking about the murder of one guy? I mean, don't get me wrong, it's a horrifying development, but I find it just so difficult to believe that this is what finally made people question the utility of the U.S.-Saudi relationship. And then I got to disagree with you a little, Trevor, on the most, so I'm going to say the most underrated foreign policy development of the year is actually China, or a specific Chinese issue, which is the incarceration of over a million Uyghurs inside China. This is a topic that in any other administration we would be literally wailing and gnashing our teeth over. And to be frank, even as a restrainer, it's not clear to me what the US response to this should be. It's horrifying. We're not talking about it at all. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, that's a big one. That's huge.
Okay, well, on that note, then let's turn and look forward into 2019. What are you guys looking to?
Well, in my sort of area, one thing that's been a very interesting development to see over time is the partisan future of foreign policy coming up. Emma, you had a great piece recently in a Texas National Security Review roundtable that was looking at conservative foreign policy. They also had a issue about progressive foreign policy. But this has really become, I think in the last 6 months of 2018 especially, has become a bigger deal with a lot of really smart progressives and conservatives writing articles and long form things and sort of sussing out what foreign policy wants to be. And I think there's a lot of common ground between restrainers and progressives when it comes to the future of that foreign policy. But you know, I think it's going to be an interesting intellectual churn. And I think we're going to get something out of it that kind of breaks from the current track we're on.
You know, I gotta, it's funny, we did podcasts on here this year with conservative and liberal foreign policy thinkers. I contributed to this roundtable, as Eric noted. I'm not actually convinced the future of foreign policy is partisan, though. I know that the debates are happening in the parties right now for electoral reasons, but I honestly think the future of foreign policy, even if it's different than it is today, is probably still quite a bipartisan phenomenon. I don't know if you guys disagree with that.
I think a lot of that might have to do with what the Democratic Party does, as it has taken back the Congress, and we've seen the rise of more and more sort of explicitly progressive people in that party. I wonder if that's something that, if it has legs and can keep going, then that might contribute to a more partisan nature of it.
Yeah, I agree with you, Eric. And I think one of the, you know, it was one of the reasons I went into foreign policy studies instead of domestic politics is because I hate domestic politics. So I liked staying away from that. But it's definitely the case that in the last 10 years that foreign policy has become much more politicized and polarized. And so it's much more partisan than it's ever been. And so the incentives, I think, for both parties to continue in that vein is fairly strong, stronger than it's ever been, number one. And number two, I do think both parties face serious challenges, as Em and I are working on in another piece, both inside both parties, between folks who want to make it even more partisan and then folks who maybe would be more likely to follow a bipartisan consensus. And so when you read Bernie Sanders, you read Elizabeth Warren, you read some of these other folks writing about progressive foreign policy, it looks an awful lot like something most conservatives would not be involved in terms of a bipartisan. And part of that, I think, is something else that the 2018 and Trump has showed us, which is domestic politics and foreign policy are not as separate anymore as they used to be. So I think the future is maybe more partisan, but I'm not ready to call it yet.
You know, it's unfortunate that, though, because at its heart, I think the foreign policies that those people are espousing actually are quite similar to the foreign policy that certain kinds of conservatives would also advocate for. It's just that the framing is very different. So if you're going to frame it in terms of, you know, a fight against global kleptocracy, then you're going to have trouble reaching across the aisle. If you frame it in terms of responsible stewardship of America's resources and national security, then you're going to have partners. So I know what you're saying, that I think if the Democratic Party frames it in this confrontational way, it may be harder to reach consensus in the long run.
Well, I just fairly closely read Elizabeth Warren's thing, and she says one of the classic buzzwords of partisan conflict. She calls out multinational corporations over and over again. I mean, this is a guarantee of zero bipartisan cooperation. When you make it a class conflict thing, the Republicans are going to go, that's not going to sell, and we don't want any part of it. So I don't think Elizabeth Warren wants to work with Republicans, frankly, on that stuff. Yes. I think a lot of these folks don't.
But it's funny, though, because like if she's talking about multinational corporations and she's talking about class issues and trade, she's basically wading into the exact same place that Trump is on foreign policy. So he's appealing to people with the exact same ideas.
Yeah, which are Democrats and maybe Reagan Democrats. And as Brian McGrath told us, not conservative Republicans at all, historically. Like, Trump has taken the Republican Party's foreign policy in a bizarre non-Republican direction. And it's, you know, maybe Pat Buchanan was that version of Republican, but he wasn't particularly Republican to most Republicans either. So yeah, I think that, you know, it's possible. I mean, if Steve Bannon has his way, the cleavaging of foreign policies between the cosmopolitans and the nationalists. And I don't think that's where we're going, but there's some of that flavor.
Well, what about the sort of expansion of foreign policy to include all these unconventional issues like trade, like immigration, things that we used to sort of consign to this everybody agrees on them bin, and then we would just work on national security. But now it seems like these are big areas for contention.
Yeah, it seems like one thing I've sort of mentioned more and more looking at focusing on Asia, which is my area of expertise, is that it seems like U.S. foreign policy in many respects, and I think because it is incorporating these unconventional issues like trade or immigration, is becoming more and more zero-sum over time, where it is going to be a lot harder for the United States to work with traditional friends and allies on a host of issues if we kind of keep on with this course that we're going on. And I think the next president after Trump, who, whether that be in 2020 or 2024, might have to spend a lot of time, you know, stepping back from that if they want to. I just think that it's the zero sum transformation of U.S. foreign policy is going to be a real problem.
Yeah, it's pretty disturbing. Trevor, what are you watching for 2019?
Oh boy. You know, certainly I'm wondering about when the next war with Iran starts. So I Bolton surprised me by not starting anything this soon, but I worry that the nuclear deal pullout was precursor to another play. It's just not clear what that is yet, but I can't believe that they're going to leave Iran alone. And so there's another turn of the screw there. So that's something I'm thinking about. North Korea, same way, right?
Yeah.
Because maximum pressure, yada, yada. Nope. None of that seems to be working in either case. So there's another move. And those are both sort of, I don't know kind of things. So those are a couple big ones.
On North Korea side, going back to something we discussed earlier, Jeffrey Lewis's book, The 2020 Report, or 2020 Commission Report, sort of the scenario for how we get into a conflict with North Korea is a breakdown in the diplomatic process that happens, I believe, in 2019 or maybe early in 2020 in that book. And on North Korea, it's I think the South Koreans are making a lot of progress. And, you know, if the U.S. wants to keep on sort of punishing them or threatening to punish them for making progress, it could get I don't think it's going to go back to where it was in 2017 if it all falls apart. So I'm a little bit more hopeful than Jeffrey is on that front. But, you know, I think that we're going to have to make that decision pretty soon of, like, how do we want to proceed and can we loosen up some of what our demands are on the North?
Yeah, so those are obviously two of the big flashpoints that we could see conflict in over the next year, and that, you know, Iran and North Korea. Whether that's particularly with Iran, whether that's a direct conflict, or more likely, I would think a regional escalation somewhere like Syria, where we end up fighting Iranian proxies or Iranian troops. But I'm going to add to that a third one. I'm going to add Ukraine. Because just in the last month, we have seen another escalation in Ukraine. We've seen Russia effectively close the Kerch Strait to shipping. And that's the strait that links mainland Russia to Crimea. The Russians obviously are actually worried about the security of that bridge that they built. But in closing off the strait, they've also closed off traffic to a bunch of Ukrainian ports. And so there is an escalation here. And the Trump administration, despite what everybody says about them on Russia, has actually been quite pro-Ukrainian in their approach, providing lethal weapons to Ukraine, things like anti-tank missiles, and actually sort of typically supporting the regime in Kiev. So I'm going to add Ukraine as a flashpoint here that I worry a little that we could see escalation in 2019.
Yeah, that's definitely on the list. And I think complicating that is the run up to the 2020 election, when the suspicion about Russian meddling is going to continue to be in the news basically constantly. And so, you know, this is going to be interesting to see what the calculation in the White House is, because Trump has maybe some soft spot in his heart. But on the other hand, he also seems to rise to certain challenges in kind of a I will show you kind of a way. And so it's like which side is going to win out here. It's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah. All of that, I think, leaves us the 800-pound gorilla in the room, right? Which is China. Everybody's talking about China. Apparently, we're heading for an era of contestation, I think is the word that everybody's going for, with China. And China is the big challenge. Everybody agrees on that. Nobody quite agrees why it's a challenge, what we should be doing about it, what our goal is in sort of pushing back against China. But that's the big one to watch, I think.
Yeah, on every level, you get people in the sort of the debate, Eric, you know, about that you mentioned about liberal international order. There's people worried at that fundamental level that China wants to remake it into a Chinese, not liberal order. There's people worried about the economic playing field. There's people worried simply about the security playing field. Then, of course, the human rights and internal politics playing field. So, you know, Emma, as you and I have sort of talked a little bit, you know, China is this sort of perfect place on which to project any concern you have about the world, and you can find it in China. And so I think there's just going to be an awful lot of U.S. attention on China in 2019. And the question, as you raise it, is does that attention have a real purpose? Like, you know, does the United States have a kind of a collective sense of why China? I don't think so yet.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that, Trevor. And I think that an added layer to this is that there's so much, and it's not quite at the, you know, readily apparent, but you can sort of see it in the background of all these different sort of levels of competition that we're turning on China. And I think it's this issue of prestige and status. and that the U.S. has been used to being number one for a long time. And now, you know, Russia is a problem, but its sort of problem is pretty much one-dimensional, right? Military, revisionist, whatever you want to call it. But China is the whole package. It has a potential alternative economic system, you know, authoritarianism, surveillance of citizens, military power. So it has more of the complete package, and I think that means that as the U.S. structures its China policy, and it's true for both Beijing and Washington, you know, it's going to be tough for once you get on a path, it's going to be really tough for either side to deviate from it because of this sort of psychological dimension of the problem. And I think that if we, you know, we can't really make the choice for Beijing, but if we choose the path of all-out confrontation across pretty much every issue area possible, then, you know, we might be surprised at how much China is going to willing to put up with and also to push back on us. And it could be a lot harder to actually get them to change their behavior than a lot of people assume.
Yeah, all of which raises the question of whether China and foreign policy more broadly is going to end up being a big issue in the 2020 campaign, because that's going to start later this year.
Well, I mean, I agree. I mean, of course, as someone who studies these things, we all think it should be. Trump, I don't know. I mean, it's going to be a referendum on Trump. So whether that has much to do with foreign policy, maybe, maybe not. I mean, he's probably going to try to make immigration a big issue, though, right? I mean, he thinks that's his winning card. So I can see at least that piece of it, as much as you consider that foreign policy anyway.
Well, I think that's all we have time for today. That wraps us up for 2018. So thanks to everybody at home for listening this year. If you enjoy the show, let us know with a good review on iTunes or Google Play. We'd also like to say a special thanks to our producer, Jeff Geld, who will be leaving us after this episode for brighter opportunities elsewhere. We'll see you in the new year. We have episodes on immigration, on China, and much more lined up. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.